He thinks that our moral sentiments come about from basically people trying things out. So you make a judgment, you express a view, you express an opinion, you behave in a certain kind of way, and you see what other people think. How do they react?
Hello and welcome to the Essential Scholars Podcast. I'm Rosemarie Fike, and today's episode focuses on the father of the economics discipline, Adam Smith. Joining me today is the author of The Essential Adam Smith, James Otteson. James Otteson is the John T. Ryan Jr. Professor of Business Ethics and Rex and Alice A. Martin Faculty Director of the Notre Dame Deloitte Center for Ethical Leadership in the Mendoza College of Business at the University of Notre Dame. He's also a senior fellow with the Fraser Institute and a senior scholar at the Fund for American Studies. Professor Otteson has written numerous academic articles and books, including Adam Smith's Marketplace of Life, and as I mentioned, The Essential Adam Smith. His research focuses on the intersection of markets and morality, and I've heard him talk at many conferences about Adam Smith and other Scottish Enlightenment scholars. So I'm very excited to have Professor Otteson with me today. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure to be with you.
So we get to talk about the father of economics today. If there is one name in economics that non-economists are familiar with, it's Adam Smith. Mm-hmm. My husband refers to him as the invisible hand guy. So he right. is a household name and has maintained his status as a household name for hundreds of years. So who was Adam Smith and what are some of the biggest influences on his thinking about how the economy works?
Well, I think you're right to think of him as the father of the discipline of economics. I mean, so he was writing in the 18th century. He was born in 1723, died in 1790. There was no discipline called economics when he was writing. To be fair, he wasn't the first person to talk about things that we would now recognize as being in the economics field. But his now most famous book, An Inquiry into the Nature and Causes of the Wealth of Nations, came out in 1776, a very auspicious year for a lot of reasons. But that book is what's generally taken as sort of the beginning of what would become recognized as the discipline of economics. Smith himself, so he was Scottish. Don't call him English. He was Scottish. He was part of what we now think of as the Scottish, we call the Scottish Enlightenment. This is a period in the middle part of the 18th century when a lot of the really amazing advances in human intellectual endeavors were going on in Scotland, of all places. It was a kind of an improbable place for that to be going on. But everything from geology to medicine to engineering, you know, the invention of the steam engine, all of these things were going on in Scotland at this time. Smith was part of that. He was one of the most celebrated people who was part of that movement. He was good friends with other people that you will have heard of, David Hume, for example. He also knew James Watt of the steam engine fame. So this was quite an exciting time to be alive, and Smith was right in the thick of it. He was actually a professor of moral philosophy at the University of Glasgow in Scotland. So. One quick note for you about that term, moral philosophy. So in the 18th century, there were two kinds of professors at universities. There were professors of natural philosophy and professors of moral philosophy. That was it. So natural philosophy was everything that had anything to do with the external world. So everything from astronomy to botany and biology, all of that, those were all called natural philosophers. Moral philosophy was the study of anything that had anything to do with human behavior. So that was everything from what we would now think of as psychology to even human history to economics and to moral philosophy. So Smith was a moral philosopher studying in particular human behavior.
But he did touch on what we would think of as more traditional moral philosophy and ethics in his less famous today work, but it is the work that made him famous in his day, The Theory of Moral Sentiments. Did not know that that was what a professor of moral philosophy meant back in the day. I thought it was something very specific. Now, Smith was influenced by an intellectual movement in France. He spent some time in France, and he was influenced by the physiocrats, I believe. Can you tell us a little bit about how their ideas maybe influenced his later thinking?
Sure, yeah. So he, as I mentioned, he was a professor of moral philosophy at the University of Glasgow. And he did that for several years. In 1764, he resigned from that position so that he could become a tutor to a duke, the Duke of Buccleuch. And he traveled with the young duke. It was a young duke. He traveled with him to many places, including France, where he came into the conversation with people that we now call these physiocrats. So who were the physiocrats? Well, these, you know, there was a lot of interesting things going on in France related to a larger field called political economy. But what this essentially was trying to figure out what are the economic policies we should have that would enable human flourishing in our society. And it was actually these physiocrats, Turgot, and there were several of them, these French physiocrats, who were making the argument that, well, maybe having somewhat of a less active role in the economy on the part of the government could actually, maybe counterintuitively, enable greater prosperity. So this was a bit of a departure, in fact, quite a bit of a departure from most of economic thinking that had gone on throughout most of human history, to be honest. I mean, going all the way back to, say, Plato. If you remember your Plato, we don't have to have a discussion about Plato, but Plato argued that what you should have is, you know, if you want to have a good city, you should put in charge of the city the people who truly apprehend the good. Who are those people? Well, philosophers. So you should have philosopher kings and philosopher queens, and they should organize the entire city according to the conception of the good. That was a very powerful idea that persisted throughout much of human history, that what you would need is, you know, the people who are distinguished, the small group of people in society who are distinguished by whatever ultimately matters to us. Maybe it's their apprehension of the good. Maybe they're in touch with God, God's will, or the will of the gods. But the elite in some way put them in charge. What these physiocrats were wondering, and what Smith would really then build upon quite a bit, was whether, in fact, we should, as it were, lower our sights on the part of the government. So in other words, as society grows and we have more and more people who have different and disparate kinds of interests, maybe counterintuitively, rather than having more rules and more intervention and more regulation of their behavior to coordinate it, maybe we should have a little bit of a hands-off approach and allow people to engage in behaviors according to their own lights. So this term laissez-faire that you might have heard, laissez-faire, which means literally hands-off, keeping hands-off, was a term that was developed during this time. Smith would have heard these arguments, and they certainly would have affected his thinking. Now, one little note about that, if I could. Mm-hmm. Smith had been really impressed with what Isaac Newton had done in studying the natural world. So he thought Isaac Newton was sort of, you know, the professor or scientist par excellence. What had he done? He'd engaged in empirical observation of the world and tried to figure out a few rules or principles that described a lot of different kinds of behavior. Smith was very impressed with that and wondered if we couldn't do something similar with studying human behavior. Could we observe human behavior, maybe come up with a few rules that describe a lot of, or can account for a lot of disparate phenomena? So when Smith was talking to the physiocrats and others in France, he wanted to subject their ideas to something that we would today recognize as empirical verification. Let's see if it actually works. Now, this might seem perfectly obvious to us today, but, in the 18th century, there weren't many people doing empirical observation or trying to gather data. And this was one of Smith's innovations.
That's amazing. You know, that seems so natural today, because right. Most economists I know are doing empirical work, but
right.
Smith was an innovator in many ways. You bring up in your early discussion of Smith in the book, this idea of the Adam Smith problem, or the problem of two Smiths. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about that, just to kind of set up our discussion? Because we will be going into both of those important works.
Sure, yes. So So Smith only published two books in his entire career, if you can imagine such a thing. It's hardly enough to get tenure at a modern American university, but he published two books. The first one was called The Theory of Moral Sentiments, which came out in 1759. And then the now much more famous Wealth of Nations, which came out, as I mentioned, in 1776. So those were the only books he published in his lifetime. Now, each of those books went through several editions in his life. So he was revising them over the course of his life. And for many years, he was revising them side by side, at the same time revising them. But only those two books. So the so-called Adam Smith problem was something that was discussed, maybe discovered in the 19th century. So the century after Smith died. And was discussed in particular by German scholars who gave it, this very grave sounding name, Das Adam Smith Problem, which just means the Adam Smith problem. But here was the alleged problem. So he wrote two books, one on morality, one on economics. The first one on morality, The Theory of Moral Sentiments, talks about something that he calls natural human sympathy. But natural human sympathy, and then he talks about, central virtues of prudence and self-command and justice and beneficence. He talks about virtues. But almost all of that doesn't find its way into the second book about economics. So the Wealth of Nations doesn't mention his first book. It doesn't talk about these central virtues in the same sort of way. And in particular, there's no extended discussion or any apparent reliance on this notion of sympathy, natural human sympathy. So what these 19th century German scholars thought they discovered was, well, wait a minute, there seems to be a problem here. On the one hand, when you talk about morality, you have this robust picture of human virtues, and then you talk about what we now call economics, and all the virtues drop out. So what the German scholars wanted to know was, well, which is the real Adam Smith? And you can imagine, all these strange theories people came up with that, well, maybe when he was a young man, he thought there was such a thing as morality. And then he grew up and experienced the world and went to France for a while. And, everything goes south when you go to France and realize that, when you're talking about the affairs of the world and business, morality doesn't matter anymore. So this was really the so-called Adam Smith problem. I mean, it has its exegetical part, which means, how, as a matter of scholarship, how do the two books fit together? But I think what makes that an interesting problem, and why the reason people still talk about that even today, is because in some sense that's the issue that still animates us today. Can you be a fully virtuous person while fully engaged in a market economy? How do markets and morality mix? And that's really what the alleged problem is, and what those two books represent.
So you've referred to it as an alleged problem. So yes. I'm hoping that as we discuss the Wealth of Nations, you can make some comments about just where you see the connections, because I suspect you think there's more overlap between the two books than the early Germans.
Yes. Yes. And I'm happy to talk about that. But if you want to come back to that, I'll follow your lead.
Absolutely. Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about his early work. Adam Smith, sometimes maybe mistakenly gets interpreted as the guy who says greed is good, right? So I want to talk about his work on the theory of moral sentiments. And you mentioned it's all based on this idea of mutual sympathy. What does he mean by sympathy? Is it what we would say sympathy today, or does he mean something specific by that?
Yeah, that's the right question to ask, and it's the right first question. The short answer is no, he doesn't mean the same thing that the word sympathy means today. It's related to it, but not the same. So he means the, sympathy in its etymological sense of feeling with or fellow feeling. So when Smith talks about, so if you and I have a sympathy of sentiments, what that means is it doesn't mean I feel pity for you or you feel pity for me or something. What it means instead is that you and I have the same sentiments regarding some object or some person or some activity. I have the same sentiments that you do, and our sentiments are similar, which means we have a sympathy or concord or harmony of sentiments. So if you think about, take an easy example, like a book or something. If you and I both talk about a particular book and we like it to the same, relatively to the same degree, then he would say we have a sympathy of sentiments about the book. So it means a concord or harmony of sentiments. And what he does in that book, and the theory of moral sentiments really does mark, it's a kind of a new school of moral philosophy, in which, again, he's interested in engaging in some what we would today think of as empirical research. So he's, that book is really more a book of sort of moral psychology than traditional moralism or moral philosophy. And what I mean by that is that there's less in his first book, there's less talk of how we should behave or should not behave. You know, most moral philosophy, that's what it was in his day and before, and basically still today. It's sort of telling people how to behave. This is good. This is bad. This is right. This is wrong. Giving you a list of behaviors. That's less what he was interested in. What he was interested in instead was explaining how it is that human beings came up with the moral sentiments they have. So one of the things that he noticed was that almost all human beings throughout all human history, so all human societies, all human beings, they have moral sentiments. There are some things they think are morally required, some things they think are morally forbidden, and some things they think are morally optional, the sort of third category. Now, they don't always agree on what those things are, but for some reason, there seems to be something unique about being a human being that we have moral commitments. And what Smith wanted to know was, how did we get them? Why do we have them? Why do humans have them and other animals, other creatures don't seem to have them? And he noticed one other interesting thing, and that is that human beings, when they're born, so as infants, they have no moral sentiments whatsoever. So an infant has no sense of, you know, what's proper or improper to ask for or something. They just, you know, scream out whatever their wants are. They cry and demand that they get their wants satisfied. But something happens to the infant as it becomes a toddler and a child and a young person and an adult, because by the time you're an adult, you have a very sophisticated sense of moral sensibilities. You have all kinds of views about what's proper or improper to ask for, what's proper or improper ways to ask for things. So there's been some kind of transformation that has taken place. And this happens in virtually every human being's lifetime. We go from an amoralized, so no morality infancy, to a highly moralized and highly sophisticated sense of morality as adults. And that book is Smith's attempt to explain that process. So that's why I said it's something like moral psychology. He's not saying what the right moral views are or what they aren't. He's saying, trying to explain empirically how it is that human beings come through, have this process of generating moral sentiments. And then, you know, he notices that sometimes the moral sentiments overlap. They're not all just random. So that maybe suggests that there is something, you know, beyond just personal preference or something that suggests that, you know, there's a lot, there is overlap. So maybe there's some continuity among human nature or human experience that if it's not identical, that maybe it overlaps for different people in different times. So that's really what that book is about.
What's interesting is that his argument or his discussion of this process doesn't rely on any kind of religion. It doesn't rely on any kind of, you know, God dictating what is proper and improper. And you say it's an inherently earthly grounded affair.
Yes. Yeah.
So can you explain a little bit about what you mean by this? And you give this really interesting example of the solitary islander. So I think that I would love to hear you speak a little bit about those things.
Yeah. So, and I'll preface that. Thanks for asking me that. But I'll preface that by saying that, you know, that Smith scholars are divided about whether Smith's, first of all, what Smith's religious views were exactly. So he was raised, you know, as a Scotch Presbyterian, and, you know, it was a highly religious era in which he lived. And in the theory of moral sentiments, there are many references to nature with a capital N, to the author of nature, capital A. So there are many references to that in the theory of moral sentiments. But the question is, well, what work is are all of those references actually doing in the theory? And that's where there's quite a bit of controversy among scholars. So I'll tell you what my view about that is. And maybe the best way to get at it is by thinking about this example of the solitary islander. So Smith has something of a thought experiment. He says, suppose you could have a human being who grew up entirely alone on an island with no other interaction with other human beings. So, you know, other interaction, maybe other animals, but no other human beings. And so not like Robinson Crusoe, who was raised with human beings and then was stuck on an island for a period of time, but rather a human being that was from birth forward had no connection, no interaction with other human beings. If you could have such a thing, Smith asks, well, what sense of morality would such a person have? Would that person have a sense of right and wrong, of good and bad, of moral obligation or duty or moral prohibition or something like that? And, you know, maybe you have your own answer. We can come up with our own answer about that. But Smith's answer is no. He thinks such a person would have no sense of moral propriety or impropriety. So what you might, what such a person might have is, well, this feels good or this feels bad, or this is painful or this is pleasurable, or this tastes good or this doesn't taste good. You know, you might have those feelings, but no sense of what's right and wrong. So Smith thinks that in order to generate a sense of what's right and wrong, the missing ingredient from the solitary islander is other people. We have to have interactions with other people. And the way we begin to generate a sense of right and wrong is when we have this experience of being judged by other people. So, you know, going back to what we talked about a second ago, this natural sympathy that Smith talked about, he thinks that we actually have a desire for natural, for sympathy, sympathy of sentiments, so that we, and that it gives us great pleasure to know that people we care about or people in our peer groups or people around us approve of our conduct and don't disapprove of it. If we become aware that people disapprove of our conduct, it's a great deal of pain. We don't like that. It's an uncomfortable feeling. If we become aware that they approve of our conduct, it's a pleasurable feeling. We like that feeling. So Smith thinks that does two things. On the one hand, it pulls us into society with other people because we want to have that feeling of mutual sympathy with other people. But on the other hand, what it does is it acts as a kind of winnowing force. So getting rid of disagreeable behavior and encouraging agreeable behavior. And it's this process of having hundreds and thousands of interactions like this with other people that develops over time in us our moral sensibilities. So when you think about, you know, you and I as adults now, you know, what's proper or improper ways to dress, or what are improper ways to address people when you meet them or something. You know, all of these things, we have views about these, we have sensibilities about these things. They might change over time, but Smith thinks they're explained by all of these interactions we've had with other people over the years of the thousands and thousands of interactions we've had. And if we hadn't had any of those interactions, we wouldn't have any of those sensibilities. So from Smith's view, now, does that mean that there is no God? No, not necessarily. Does that mean that, you know, that God doesn't have specific things he would like for us to do or, you know, ways to behave? Maybe. But Smith's explanation for how we actually come to our moral sentiments is really this kind of earthly grounded affair that's involved in just, you know, the social interaction we have with other human beings.
It's very much a trial and error process of discovering what the right type of behavior is.
Yeah. And that can give rise to, or the question anyway of, well, does that mean it's just perfectly relative? You know, could any set of beliefs potentially be approved in particular communities? And, you know, there again, so Smith scholars, you know, have to take different positions about that. But I think the answer to that is sort of yes and no. I mean, there is certainly a relativistic sense of that. So, you know, Smith talks about some things that he thinks are going to be, you know, you're going to have lots of different views, like how to dress, what's proper dress. That's going to change over time. It's going to change, you know, from one community to another community, one country to another country. You're going to have lots of different views about that. But what's interesting on Smith's view is that there are some things that are more closely connected to things like survival, individual survival, or survival of a community or a band or a even a society. The things that are more closely connected to survival, there tends to be less and less variation. The things that are less closely connected to survival, there tends to be more variation. So that's sort of a prediction that his theory makes, but you can see how that might play out. So he does think that there are some things that turns out are pretty, seem to be necessary for human survival, meaning certain kinds of behaviors that if you engage in them, you'll die, and others that you need to engage in to survive, let alone flourish. And then lots of other things where it's not so necessarily, not so closely connected to those things. And so the things that that are closely connected to survival there, Smith thinks that may be because there are some common elements to human nature across times and places, and maybe some common elements to the human condition across times and places. And so morality would, as it develops, would reflect that.
Do you have any examples of some of these more central, important behaviors that are key to our survival?
Yeah. So Smith has his own examples, but the main one falls under the heading of what Smith calls justice. So the virtue of justice, which is obviously an old virtue, has been talked about for a very long time. Smith has his own sort of conception of what this virtue of justice is. He says that the virtue of justice requires refraining from violating other people's bodily person, so not attacking, assaulting, murdering other people. That's first. Second, after that, is respecting other people's property, their property and their possessions, not stealing their property or trespassing on their property or despoiling their property without their permission. And then third and finally, the third aspect of justice is respecting promises that you make. You make a promise, you enter into an agreement, you have a contract, you respect that. And you're held to it. If you make a voluntary promise, you're held to that. Those three aspects, so bodily person, then property and possessions, and then these promises or contracts, Smith thinks that empirically speaking, so put aside whatever we think, you know, God's will would be or something, just empirically speaking, no human society or community is going to be able to survive in which there is systematic violation of justice, so understood. So if people in your community are killing each other, stealing from each other, making false promises or violating their word or whatever, your society is not long for this world. It's not going to last very long. On the other hand, to the degree that people in your society actually do respect those things, they respect one another. So and the more people in your society. So it's not just, you know, some people are allowed to own property, but everybody's property needs to be respected and respected even if the king wants it. You still have to ask permission before taking people's property, then you're going to have a much more peaceful, enduring, prosperous society. So those are some behaviors that Smith thinks seem to be constant across all human society, all human civilization, regardless of whatever other differences there might be.
So in a way, Smith's view of morality and how we kind of generate this idea of what is acceptable and unacceptable, it is somewhat in our interest, both as a group to develop these rules, but also as an individual to listen to them in order to avoid kind of the negative feeling or the anxiety of, you know, staying up at 2 o'clock in the morning thinking about this moment where you behaved the wrong way in a social scenario. Right. So he's making kind of almost, if you think about it, a self-interested argument for why we would want to be moral.
Yeah. I mean, and I think it's a good point. And I think it's at least consistent with our individual interests. You know, maybe there's a reason, maybe there are reasons to do the right thing beyond its being in your own self-interest. But in the long run, in the long term, I think he thinks it is. I mean, you know, he has these funny examples, like one of the examples that he talks about several times that must have been one of his favorite examples because he brings it up again and again in the Theory of Moral Sentiments about joke telling. So, you know, you imagine, you know, suppose you're, this is the kind of Smith example, but so, you know, suppose you're with some of your friends and you're out, you know, having some drinks or having some dinner or something one evening, and you decide to tell a joke to the group and you tell a joke to the group and, you know, it's one of your favorite jokes and you tell it and you laugh at, you know, you laugh uproariously after you finish telling the joke, and then you look around and you realize nobody else is laughing. You're the only one laughing. Okay, now if you try to actually imagine that, you can imagine how terrible of a feeling. It's probably already causing some anxiety just imagining doing that.
Making me cringe. Yes. Yes,
exactly. Making you cringe. So Smith finds that example fascinating because he wonders, well, first of all, where do the rules about joke telling come from? You know, why are some things funny and other things not funny? But why does that have such a pull on us? It has such purchase on us. If everybody else laughs hysterically at your joke, you're going to feel so good about yourself and it's going to be so great and wonderful. But if people don't laugh at your joke, you really feel that. It has a strong negative effect on us. And so Smith thinks that this is actually quite a telling example because it actually points to, it has lessons for much more broadly for other kinds of behavior as well. We really want to have the sympathy of sentiments when everybody laughs with us, and we want to avoid the antipathy of sentiments when people don't have the same feeling that we do. And he thinks that this gives rise, even on sort of unwittingly, without us realizing it, it gives rise to all kinds of interesting things like, well, rules about how long you should, I mean, do you think there are rules about how long you should laugh at a joke? You know, is there such a thing as laughing too long at a joke? Well, probably. You know, are there jokes that would be improper to tell in some settings, but might be proper to tell in other settings? Absolutely. Probably. Yeah. And does that change over time? Sure. So all of that, Smith thinks, can be explained by this interactive process of looking for mutual sympathy of sentiments, trying things out, seeing the reactions you get, and then adjusting and mutually adjusting our behaviors so that we increase the chances of mutual sympathy, we decrease the chances of mutual antipathy, and it brings about over time a kind of, I mean, I'm going to use an economics term, so you forgive me, but it's approaching a general equilibrium about these things, where people have a sense of what's proper and improper. It can change over time, but there are some aspects of it that tend not to change very much over time.
You describe it as a marketplace for morality in one of the chapters of the book.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about, you know, what type of environment cultivates a, you know, competitive market for morality where we're able to discover these rules that help us live better together?
Yeah. So you're probably going to get too angry at me if I push on that marketplace of morality too hard. You being an economist who actually understands about these things. But I think there are some similarities, which is why I use that. You know, it's an interesting analogy. So I think Smith's view is that, you know, if you think about prices in an economic market, you know, where do prices come from? Maybe you think, oh, there's some person who comes up with prices and just tells everybody what the price is. But that's not actually how it works. You know, prices come from, people have their aspirational prices. I would like to sell my house for $1 million. And you have your aspirational price. I'd like to buy your house for $5,000. Okay, well, I have my aspirational price. You have your aspirational price. Those don't become real prices until we say yes, until we come to an agreement. Then we have a real price. Well, so the real price reflects your interests plus your resources and your obligations and the scarcity of resources, et cetera, and mine as well, my schedule of values, the things that matter to me, the trade-offs, et cetera. So that's what prices reflect in an economic marketplace, as long as we're freely able to, you know, say yes or no. I think there's something similar going on in what I call the marketplace of life, or in particular of morality for Smith. He thinks that our moral sentiments come about from basically people trying things out. So you make a judgment, you express a view, you express an opinion, you behave in a certain kind of way, and you see what other people think. How do they react? And we pay close attention to it. I mean, in fact, we're extremely good both at expressing moral judgment and perceiving moral judgment. I mean, if you think about, you know, how many ways are there for you to express, I don't like what you did, without actually saying those words.
Yes. My husband tells me I need to control my eyebrows a lot because I really don't have the ability to stop what they do. They express my feelings for me without words.
Yes. So there are lots of ways, you know, but through body language and lots of other things that where we express our views, even sometimes unconsciously, or you're not, you know, trying to do so. People who are observing you are paying close attention too. So we pay very close attention to these things. And so the analogy, I think, is that what ends up becoming, you know, sort of an ingrained part of my character, you know, a way that I behave regularly or somewhat predictably, is a result of having tried out a lot of things and gotten a lot of feedback. Now, you know, just getting feedback doesn't mean that you necessarily pay attention to it. So Smith does say that there are times when, you know, that a moral adult, so you and I, and, you know, probably anybody who's going to be watching or listening to us, there will be some people's opinions that you're not going to value very much. Maybe there are people who have negative opinions of you, but those, they aren't part of your peer group, or they aren't part of the group that really matters to you, your closer friends, your family, maybe your colleagues or peers. So we do make discriminations among, you know, whose opinions matter more to us and whose opinions matter less. But nevertheless, among the people who actually do matter to us, and that will be partly reflective of the topics or the things that matter to us. You know, if you're interested in politics, you're probably going to hang around with people who have political views that are similar to yours. If you're interested in economics, you're going to hang around with people who are interested in economics and maybe who have similar economics views to yours, et cetera. Religious views, literature, et cetera, music, et cetera. Smith's view is that we're still going to be very sensitive to the negative feedback in particular. Positive feedback is good, but it's really the negative feedback that we remember that really affects us, that stings us. So over time, our behavior is going to come to reflect the kinds of negative feedback that we've gotten on the basis of our offers, as it were. You know, go back to kind of the economic market. We make offers. You know, here's what I think. Does anybody want to buy it? And buying it means something like giving me positive mutual sympathy of sentiments, positive feedback. If I get positive feedback, that encourages me to do more. If I get negative feedback, it discourages me, et cetera. So that phrase, sort of the marketplace of morality, I think is capturing that part of the market. And the other thing I wanted to mention is that you in your question, when you phrased the question, you asked about sort of the competitive market. You know, what's competitive? Well, there is a sense in which we're competing for each other's sympathy of sentiments. So we can't agree with everybody's sentiments at all the time. So our concern for others, our love for others, our admiration for others, those are scarce resources. They're limited, which means that, you know, we can't love everybody. We can say that, but we can't actually love everybody. So we're competing for those. We compete for one another's affection. We compete for one another's attention. We compete for social status in other people's eyes. All of those things are elements of social competition that also play an important role in deciding and determining what kinds of moral sentiments and what kinds of behavior we actually engage in.
So I want to switch gears a little bit because I do want to talk about The Wealth of Nations as well.
Ah, yes.
and I think this is a good segue, because how you were describing that process of feedback and avoiding the negative feedback sounds a lot like Smith's discussion of the invisible hand process of the market.
Yeah.
So can you talk a little bit about, you know, the Wealth of Nations, you know, the invisible hand, and some of the major contributions that Smith made in that book?
Yeah. So that's a big question. It's a big book. I mean, just a note about the process of composing that book. I mean, you have to remember, so he's writing in the 18th century. That book is over 1,000 pages long. And he wrote it at a time when, you know, there was no internet. There weren't even computers. There weren't telephones, televisions. There wasn't even electricity yet. So, you know, how on earth did he, so he wrote it by hand. It was all written out by hand. Took him, you know, a couple of decades of writing that book, to write the book. But when you flip through the book, so, you know, I invite everybody to read the entire thing. But until you read the entire thing, you know, as you flip through it, some of the things you'll notice are he's got tables of production of different crops in different places in Europe by year. Just think about trying to get that kind of data in the 18th century, you know, before there were, you know, you couldn't even pick up a phone. You know, who do you ask for this? But Smith has data about various countries. So this kind of data, so crop production, for example, from France, Germany, Spain, Portugal, Italy, of course, England and the British Isles. He even gets some information about places as far as away as India and China. He's got some information about the Americas. Quite an impressive feat in the 18th century. But why? So what, you know, to what end? Why are you getting all, trying to get all of this? Again, this is going to seem perfectly obvious to us today or to you today, any economist today, you're going to think, of course, this is what you would do. But in Smith's day, this was a genius idea. So here was his idea. So he was noticing that some places in the world were getting wealthy and other places were not. And what he wanted to know was why. Why are some places getting wealthy and other places are not? Why are some places already wealthy, but maybe they seem to be stagnating a little bit? Other places are not as wealthy, but are increasing. So he wanted to know why. And as a something of an empirical scientist, he wanted to see, can we figure this out? This seems like a question maybe we could figure out. So one of his methods was, let's suppose I could get in France, from the different regions of France, the levels of crop production every single year for a century. Suppose I could get that. And I just, you know, how much are they producing every single year for all these different regions for an entire century? And it goes, sometimes it goes up and sometimes it goes down. And then suppose he says, okay, well, let's look at what laws were in place. What were the policies in place at each of those years? And let's see if we can find any patterns. Did production increase with certain kinds of policies and decrease with other kinds of policies? And well, what do you know? There do seem to be some patterns. Okay, so if there's some patterns in France, let's compare that to Germany and see if you get the same patterns. What about Spain, Portugal, Italy, et cetera? Suppose it turned out to be the case that you get the same kinds of patterns recurring again and again. That is, you get increasing production of goods and services with a certain set of rules or laws or regulations in place, and you get stagnating or decreasing production under a different but specific set, well, then that would be important to know. And that might not only be interesting, but from Smith's view, as remember, he was a moral philosopher, and from Smith's view, you know, eliminating poverty from the world seems like a good thing. So if we can figure out how to raise people out of poverty, and what policies can enable that to happen, to can enable greater abundance or greater plenty in the world, these are terms that he uses, then it seems like this is something we ought to try to figure out. And that's what he thinks he's done in The Wealth of Nations. That's what that book is all about.
So what's the secret? What is the secret to The Wealth of Nations?
Ah, you want the answer. Yes.
Yeah, he gives it right away.
He does. Yes. In fact, yeah, the first, you would think, you know, he spent, you know, years working on this. It's 1,000 pages long. It's got all of this other, you know, discussion in it. You know, what are the things, if somebody asked you, you know, suppose you didn't know everything about economics that you already know, or about, you know, economic history, you know, what kinds of things would you think might explain why some places are wealthy and other places aren't? You know, a lot of the things that you'd come up with, he does discuss, you know, is favorable geography, does that matter? Demography, does that matter? Natural resources, does that matter? So he talks about those things, investigates them. He thinks those things tend to be, they can help or they can hurt, but other things matter more than those things. And so what matters more? Well, he puts it right at the beginning of the book, as he just said. The very first chapter of The Wealth of Nations is called On the Division of Labor. That seems like a kind of underwhelming division of labor. So the key is somehow the division of labor. Well, so here's Smith's view. I can give it to you very simply, the sort of recipe. If you want a recipe, Smith's idea is that no matter how wealthy or poor or whatever else is going on in your country, if you would like to become more prosperous, if you'd like to become wealthier, here's what you should do. You should, first of all, have the public institutions that allow the division of labor. Why should you allow the division of labor? Because when labor is divided, production increases. So whatever it is you're making, if you divide the labor, you know, among many workers, as opposed to having each individual worker make an entire thing from start to finish, you get greater production. And it's not marginally greater, it's hugely greater, exponentially greater. Production goes way up. Okay, so that's step one. Allow for the division of labor. If you allow for the division of labor, you get increasing production. If you get increasing production, other things being held equal, what happens to the prices of those things? Well, the more you have of something, what happens to the price of it? Other things equal, the prices come down. As the price comes down, and as that process spreads to more and more goods, services across many industries or across the economy, increasing production across an economy, the prices of things, of many things, start coming down because you have a greater abundance of them. As that process unfolds, what happens to the standard of living? Standard of living goes up. And so there you have it. There's the magic recipe, according to Smed. What really matters to people is having more and more goods and services that they can use and consume, that they can put to their own ends to make their own, improve their situations, make their lives better. And as more of those things become available, especially, by the way, and not for nothing, to the poor. I mean, wealthy people, the king and the queen and the barons and the lords, they have always been able to get, theirs. But as the prices of goods and services comes down, that puts it within the ability of ever more poor people to afford, which means you're actually improving the lives of the poor. And that's really the magic recipe. So it doesn't sound very complicated, although it has proved, very difficult for many people to accept, but that's the recipe.
So why does division of labor increase productivity so significantly?
Yeah, good question. So I'll tell you what Smith says about that. And you as a contemporary economist, you can tell us whether you think he's right about that. But so he says, this is what he says. He gives this famous example of a pin making factory, little pins, like you get with your shirt, when you buy a shirt or something. In the 18th century, those were quite a luxury because they required a lot of labor. They were quite expensive. Not many people had pins. But Smith apparently did a little field work, and he went and looked at different places that were trying to produce pins. Some of them, you had a single craftsman who would make the pin from start to finish. So it would draw out the wire, cut the wire, shave the pin, the head of it and all that. Smith said that most workers making these pins from start to finish will make only one in an entire day. It'll take a whole day to make one. If they're really good, they might make 10 in a day. And the absolute master craftsman could make up to 20 in a day. So that was it. But then he compares that to a shop where you have several different workers. One worker draws the wire, a different worker cuts it, et cetera. What do you get there? Not 10 or even 20 per worker, you get something like 4,000 per worker. So, it's a huge increase. So why? The more we do any one thing, the better at it we get. He thinks we just get better at it. Our dexterity increases. We also don't lose time switching from one task to another. And then the third and final and the most important one for him is that it means that the worker who's actually working on something figures out new ways to do it. You come up with new innovations, new ways to save your labor, to increase the production. We have innovations, we have new ideas, and those really lead to greater increase in productivity. So dividing the labor in that way allows more people to sort of own part of the process. And if you own part of the process, you come up with ways to increase the production. And so that leads to this great increase in overall production.
Well, we need to wrap up for today's conversation, so we're almost out of time. I want to say thank you so much for talking to me today about the ideas of Adam Smith. And I'm eager to continue our conversation, get into a little bit more of a discussion of The Wealth of Nations and how that book can help us guide through some difficult policy decisions of our modern day. So thank you so much, and I look forward to continuing the chat.
I do too. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Essential Scholars, a new podcast series that explores the ideas and insights of some of history's most influential thinkers. If you've enjoyed today's episode, please be sure to subscribe and head over to essentialscholars.org to learn more. See you next time.